last opportunity to escape an eternity of separation from his blessed countenance. Life is uncertain. Tomorrow's sun may never rise. Eternity may be but a heartbeat away. Graham did not wring such themes for every ounce of anxiety and fear they might hold, but seldom did he let an invitation pass without giving them at least a twist or two. It was not high pressure, but it was pressure nonetheless. And he felt no qualms in using it to move them to make the decision toward which all his preaching pointed. "I'm going to ask you to get up out of your seats," he would announce, "and come and stand in front of the platform and say, 'Tonight, I want Christ in my heart.'" And then suddenly, and unlike most revivalists who continued to badger and plead and cajole throughout the invitation hymn, he stopped talking, closed his eyes, rested his chin on his right fist, cradled his right elbow in his left hand, and waited for the Holy Spirit to move, for men and women and boys and girls to decide that this would be the day of their salvation. For all his vitality and carefully honed technique, Graham was far from flawless as a preacher. He often insisted he was no scholar or intellectual, and his sermons were studded with garish justification of his modesty. He seemed to specialize in sweeping generalization and oversimplification, as when he declared that almost all ministers of the gospel and students of the Bible agree that the post-war rise of Russia is masterminded by Satan himself, or blithely proclaimed in a sermon on the sins of the tongue that the problems of the world could be solved overnight if the world could get victory over the tongue. In similar fashion, he asserted that the major reasons for the immorality of youth in mid-century America were the troubled marriages of Lana Turner and Rita Hayworth, Ingrid Bergman's notorious affair with Roberto Rossellini, and two frank discussions of marital problems. On other occasions, he offered dubious or glaringly erroneous renderings of the thought of authorities he cited, as when he overlooked Thomas Jefferson's well-known deism and credited him with having believed that man's salvation, his only real freedom, is found in a personal knowledge of Jesus Christ, because he gives freedom from fear of death, from sin, or when he lumped Nietzsche, Freud, and Schleiermacher together under the heading of behavioristic philosophies. Such naive statements gave more learned and sophisticated critics ample excuse to dismiss Graham as an undereducated zealot. But they detracted hardly at all from the quality that gave his preaching its strength and power, the unmistakable authority of his proclamation. The source of his authority, of course, was the Bible, and his absolute confidence in its truth. It was for him a saber whose strength and sharpness he used to slash deeply into the consciousness of his hearers. He understood intuitively that countless multitudes, not everyone to be sure, but far more than enough to fill the largest arena in any city, want to be told what to believe by someone who believes in himself. He advised ministers to hide whatever doubts they might have and to preach what they do believe with full conviction. "People want to be told authoritatively that this is so," he said, "not to be given pro and con arguments. The world longs for finality and authority. It is weary of theological floundering and uncertainty. Belief exhilarates people. Doubt depresses them." His own belief was final and unshakable, if not fully explicable, and because he had no doubts, he was able to convey in his voice, his gestures, and his absolute forthrightness a personal authority that bolstered and exemplified the authority of Scripture. He did not defend his belief. He proclaimed it in clear and perfectly intelligible language so that no one could doubt or misunderstand what he wanted them to do. Though Graham often spoke of social problems of national and global magnitude, he offered few suggestions for dealing with them other than accepting Christ as one's personal Savior. In part, this was because he considered himself an evangelist, not a theologian or social reformer. More crucial was his conviction, widely shared among evangelicals, that the only way to change society is to change individual men and women who would then act as a leavening agent to make society more Christian, which he seemed to assume would naturally cause it to resemble the decent, hard-working, middle-class, patriotic, capitalist society to which he belonged, and in which he felt most comfortable. He and his fellow evangelicals did not expect to bring about widespread and basic social change by promoting legislation or disobeying laws that seemed clearly unjust. In 1947, Carl F. H. Henry, one of the most prominent and perhaps the most gifted of the young evangelical theologians, wrote a pivotal book, The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, in which he lamented his own movement's lack of sensitivity to social problems. Modernists had an insufficient view of the gospel, he believed, but they often demonstrated a concern for society that put fundamentalists to shame. If evangelicals were to have the impact they ought to have, they must develop a more progressive social message. Harold John Okinge agreed. Evangelicals, he insisted, must concern themselves not just with personal salvation and doctrinal truth, but also with the problems of race, of war, of class struggle, of liquor control, of juvenile delinquency, of immorality, and of national imperialism. Orthodox Christians cannot abdicate their responsibility in the social scene. Also in 1947, radio preacher Charles Fuller, with strong encouragement from Henry, Okinge, and other leading evangelicals, founded Fuller Theological Seminary, one of whose goals was to encourage a more socially enlightened ministry. Graham was aware of these currents of modest change and was particularly impressed by Carl Henry's book, but his overriding passion for winning souls outweighed his social concerns. And his solutions to major social problems were typically those of evangelical individualism and pietistic moralism. Get individuals to attend church, read their Bibles, and pray, and social problems will vanish. And he showed only limited appreciation for corporate efforts to effect social change. He occasionally conceded that organized labor had helped reduce exploitation and ameliorate insufferable conditions in the workplace. He noted with pride that Wesley's revivals had stimulated improvements in working conditions in England, and often noted that Keir Hardie, the founder of the British Labour Party, had been one of D.L. Moody's converts. He was careful to point out that employers should regard their workers not just as manpower, but as human beings, should provide them with a safe and pleasant work environment, and treat them with fairness, generosity, and respect, and that responsible workers should give an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and not stoop to take unfair advantage of their employers. To encourage such a whistle-while-you-work atmosphere, his associates visited industrial sites in every crusade city, setting up prayer groups they hoped would improve relations between employers and employees. And he urged employers and workers to save a seat for Jesus at the bargaining table. I guarantee, he said, that if labor and management alike would bow their knees to Almighty God and ask Him for a solution, they would solve their problems overnight. If Christ reigned in these labor discussions, we would enter an industrial utopia. Still, his reference to the Garden of Eden as a paradise in which there were no union dues, no labor leaders, no snakes, no disease, clearly reflected his preference for a world free of unions and the conflict they produced. Neither Graham's supporters nor his critics expected or demanded much more of him on most problems facing society during the 1950s. But he could not easily avoid more comprehensive attention to two issues threatening to rend the fabric of unity woven by the war and the following period of recovery. Those issues were communism and racism. The first he could not resist. The second he could not avoid. To Graham, communism was such an unqualified evil that he regarded attacks on it as but the slightest departure from his ostensible political neutrality. At a pre-crusade press conference, he told newspeople that not once will you hear from this platform an attack, by implication or otherwise, against any religious or political group. The only one I mention from the platform occasionally is communism, which is anti-God, anti-Christ, and anti-American. On the hour of decision, he declared that the struggle between communism and Christianity was a battle to the death. Either communism must die or Christianity must die, because it is actually a battle between Christ and Antichrist. And he told a Nashville reporter, "I think it gets its power from the devil." In keeping with that conviction, the first printed sermon he distributed to hour of decision listeners was Christianity versus Communism. In it, he characterized communists as devotees of a religion created and directed by Satan himself. The devil is their god, Marx their prophet, Lenin their saint, and Malenkov their high priest. These disciples of Lucifer, he charged, seek in devious and various ways to convert a peaceful world to their doctrine of death and destruction. Graham, like many Americans, expressed admiration for those claiming to find subversives in government and elsewhere in American society. When Senator Joseph McCarthy, frustrated by witnesses who refused to answer his badgering questions, called for changes in the Fifth Amendment, Graham recommended that if that was what it took, then let's do it. Even after McCarthy's and similar committees came under heavy fire for their abusive and demagogic tactics, Graham persisted in his admiration for their efforts. In a 1953 sermon, a year before the Senate censured McCarthy, he said, "While nobody likes a watchdog, and for that reason many investigation committees are unpopular, I thank God for men who, in the face of public denouncement and ridicule, go loyally on in their work of exposing the Pinks, the Lavenders, and the Reds who have sought refuge beneath the wings of the American Eagle, and from that vantage point, try in every subtle, undercover way to bring comfort, aid, and help to the greatest enemy we've ever known, communism." As McCarthy became more intemperate, and as his opponents began to demonstrate that he was a liar and a charlatan, Graham began to back away from him and his ilk. He admitted that while there might be some leftist, Marxist thinking in American churches, as McCarthy and others charged, he did not know of any such cases personally, and was opposed to having people put under suspicion without solid documentary facts and proof. And in 1954, when reporters pressed him for a statement, he said, "I have never met McCarthy, corresponded with him, exchanged telegrams, or telephoned him. I have no comments to make on the senator." When they asked whether, simply as a Christian leader, he did not have some opinion on McCarthyism, he replied, "I'm not answering that." A few weeks later, he informed President Eisenhower that most people are laughing off the McCarthy hearings, and were not giving them the kind of seriousness they had earlier received. Later that year, however, when the Senate voted to censure McCarthy, Graham observed that, like Nero during the burning of Rome, the Senate was fiddling over trifles and bringing disgrace to the dignity of American statesmanship by making such a fuss. Other patriotic Americans, besides Billy Graham, including Robert F. Kennedy, who worked for McCarthy for 6 months before becoming disillusioned, had been taken in by the junior senator from Wisconsin, and despite his apparent willingness to modify the Constitution, if it would help ferret out enemies of freedom, Graham's tolerant spirit made him uncomfortable with McCarthy's excesses once he understood their implications. Still, his conviction that America was locked in a death struggle with Satan's own ideology kept him from ever declaring flatly that Joseph McCarthy had also been an enemy of freedom. Graham by no means believed that all of America's problems were caused by communists themselves. Equally at fault were American leaders who had underestimated the communist threat, had listened to bad advice, and had followed a course of appeasement that encouraged communist aggression of the very sort that led to the war in Korea. "We've lost prestige in the Far East, shown weakness, betrayed friends," he lamented. "Our morally weakened allies are now calling for the admission of Red China into the United Nations, and crying for the scalp of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek on Formosa." Such a faltering approach, he warned, was doomed to fail. There can be no bargaining, there can be no parleying or compromising with evil. America must stand firm, no matter what it costs. Firmness did not necessarily entail support of the United Nations. In a 1953 sermon, America's Decision, he observed that we have been caught in the web of the United Nations, then quoted a Life editorial that had said of the UN's intervention in Korea, "They set the policies, we shed the blood and pay the bills." Though Graham would come to have a higher opinion of the UN in later years, he criticized it during the Korean conflict for its failure to stand up to Russia, and ventured that a root cause of its sometimes spineless behavior was its lack of a clear theistic foundation. At the first meeting of the United Nations in San Francisco, there was no prayer made to God for guidance and blessing. "We were afraid that the godless, atheistic communists would not like it, so we bowed in deference to Russia." Such statements earned Graham recognition as a staunch anti-communist. The Chicago Daily News characterized him as communism's public enemy number one, and the Soviet Army newspaper, Red Star, denounced him as a quack, a charlatan, and a howling hysteric whose comments on world affairs impressed only simpletons inexperienced in politics. With equal vehemence, East German papers depicted him as a hypocritical demagogue fronting for a warmongering White House and soulless Wall Street capitalists. Clearly, however much impact they assigned to his efforts, the communists regarded Graham as something more than just another itinerant missionary. For all the seriousness of the communist threat, attacking it was a relatively risk-free enterprise. Evangelists since Billy Sunday had pounded on communism with impunity. Not many communists wandered into their tabernacles, and few fundamentalists held up a hand to argue that their communist friends had been misunderstood. All Graham had to do was avoid looking foolish. Racism posed a much trickier problem. Many Christians, as well as many observers who were not Christians, felt Graham ought to use all his influence to denounce segregation and prejudice. At the same time, others among his supporters, particularly in the South, continued to defend racist policies and practices and did not want him to meddle with what they regarded as a God-ordained system. To complicate matters even further, increased reliance by blacks on various forms of public protest ran counter to Graham's own deep abhorrence for conflict and impropriety. The complexities of that problem would dog him for decades. As a son of the South, Graham inherited a view of blacks as a qualitatively different and inferior people. It was sort of an unspoken assumption that we were in a different class, he recalled. Whether it was master and or servant, I don't know. It was with some people, I'm sure. I don't think I ever analyzed it when I was a boy. Like many Southerners, however, he was not exposed to a particularly virulent form of racism. His father used the word nigger, later softening it to nigra and then to negro, but he also hired Reese Brown, a black man who had been to school and served as a sergeant in World War I, to be foreman of the dairy farm. Billy admired Brown, worked alongside him, learned from him, played with his children, and shared meals at his table. Experiences that made it difficult to sustain any notion of blacks as subhuman creatures. He often claimed that after his conversion, he found it difficult to reconcile racial discrimination with worship of a God who is no respecter of persons. But these misgivings remained latent for a number of years. Bob Jones College and Florida Bible Institute were whites' only schools, and issues of racial justice did not arise. Wheaton College had been founded by abolitionists, and its student body included a sprinkling of black students, some of whom Billy befriended. His anthropology studies taught him that race is a quite imprecise term and concept often used by lay people to explain such obviously non-genetic traits as language, religion, and social values. He also learned that most of the world's peoples, including those responsible for some of humanity's greatest achievements, are of mixed heritage. But these experiences and insights demanded no radical response. Most evangelicals, even in the North, did not think it their duty to oppose segregation. It was enough to treat the blacks they knew, personally, with courtesy and fairness. And Billy found that quite easy to do. Dr. Bell, whom he admired tremendously, saw no contradiction between being a Christian and endorsing traditional Southern racial attitudes, and he strongly urged his son-in-law to stay away from social reform efforts that might deflect him from his primary task of winning souls. During the early years of his independent ministry, Graham followed the example set by Billy Sunday and others by holding segregated meetings, wherever that was the local custom. In Los Angeles and New England, blacks were welcomed and free to sit wherever they liked. But the few who supported his crusade in Columbia, South Carolina, were obliged to sit in a clearly designated colored section. When he returned to New England for his reprise tour, reporters grilled him about his acquiescence to this racist practice. He had no persuasive defense for not taking a stronger stand, but he affirmed his belief that the gospel is for all people, regardless of color, and that spiritual revival, which he professed to see on every hand, was the only dependable way to break down racial barriers. He managed to avoid a major controversy. But awareness that a skeptical public would be watching everything he did pricked his increasingly uneasy conscience. In Portland that summer, he objected to the automatic assumption that just because he was a Southern Baptist, he also favored racial inequality. All men are created equal under God, he said flatly. Any denial of that is a contradiction of holy law. Brave words and good copy. But 2 months later, he accepted just such a denial and contradiction by preaching to segregated audiences throughout his Atlanta crusade. Though Georgia was experiencing considerable racial tension at the time, Graham railed against the evils of alcohol, drugs, crime, divorce, and suicide, but said nothing about the evils of racism. It troubled him that few blacks attended his services, and that the Black Ministerial Association indignantly refused, and the leading black newspaper vigorously criticized his offer to hold a special service for blacks only. Unfortunately, he was not sufficiently troubled either to speak out boldly against racism or to demand that his next several Southern crusades in Fort Worth, Shreveport, Memphis, Greensboro, and Raleigh be integrated. It bothered him that blacks stayed away, but he resisted any action that might engender conflict or offend his white hosts. During his brief Hollywood Bowl crusade in 1951, he tried to play both sides of the issue, announcing that he personally favored improved race relations, but that organized reform efforts were likely to do more harm than good, especially since it seemed to him that communists and communist sympathizers were at the root of most such efforts. Once again, he could imagine no route to racial harmony that did not run past the cross. "You can't clean up a city," he said, "until you clean up the hearts and minds of individuals. And the only successful method of accomplishing this is to lead them to an acceptance of Christian faith." Graham's insistence on individual rather than social change doubtless gave comfort to advocates of racial gradualism and massive resistance alike, since it placed the onus of conflict on those who wanted to change the system, but it was not a hypocritical dodge. He genuinely believed he was right, and he began ever so gingerly to suggest it was time for individual Christians to start accepting the implications of a gospel whose central assertion is that Christ died for all people, whatever their color. On the hour of decision, he declared that for America to remain strong, its people would have to affirm and demonstrate confidence in one another, race with race, creed with creed, color with color. Before his 1952 Washington crusade, he announced there would be no discrimination in seating arrangements. And when liberal Washington clergymen criticized his lack of coherent social message, he replied that at conversion, you become obedient to spiritual laws. You begin to love persons of all races, regardless of the color of their skin. It's just love, 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 love for all people of the world. In Houston a few weeks later, he acceded to the local committee's desire for segregated seating, but set aside a shady portion of Rice University's stadium for blacks instead of assigning them to a less desirable sunny section, as was customary. In addition, he held a special service, this time at their request, for nearly 500 black leaders, whom he warned not to make their problems worse by turning them over to a gang of international bandits. Then at the 1952 Southern Baptist Convention, he startled some of his brethren by asserting that it was the Christian duty of every Baptist college to welcome academically qualified Negro students. "The moral statue of the Baptist people," he warned, "can rise no higher than the policies of the Baptist educators." Graham clearly felt an obligation to speak against segregation, but he also believed his first duty was to appeal to as many people as possible. Sometimes he found these two convictions difficult to reconcile. That summer in Jackson, Mississippi, in the heart of the Black Belt, he accepted segregated seating, but defied Governor Hugh White's request that he hold entirely separate services for blacks. During that crusade, a white minister who had been president of a black college made him understand that his growing prominence meant he could not avoid such public stands. "Human justice is on their side," the man said. "But more than that, religion is too. You're taking leadership in the field of evangelism, and this is something you're going to have to face." Near the close of the crusade, Graham took another step by not only proclaiming that God's love knows no racial barriers, but by identifying Jackson's two greatest social problems as illegal liquor, Mississippi was still dry, and segregation. "With respect to the latter," he said, "there is no scriptural basis for segregation. It may be there are places where such is desirable to both races, but certainly not in the church." He acknowledged that he accepted it in his southern crusades, where local custom demanded, but said it made him uncomfortable to do so. "The ground at the foot of the cross is level," he said, "and it touches my heart when I see whites stand shoulder to shoulder with blacks at the cross." These statements stirred a chorus of amens and hallelujahs from the black section and applause from the editors of the Christian Century, who predicted his forthrightness would hurt him in the South. Both responses were correct, and when segregationists criticized him, he immediately backtracked. He told the local newspaper, "I feel that I have been misinterpreted on racial segregation. We follow the existing social customs in whatever part of the country in which we minister. As far as I've been able to find in my study of the Bible, it has nothing to say about segregation or non-segregation. I came to Jackson to preach only the Bible and not to enter into local issues." Just one day earlier, preaching the Bible required that segregation be condemned and characterized the practice as on a par with bootleggers' moonshine, only one rung lower than immorality on the ladder of major sins. When it appeared that such a message might shrink the size of his potential audience, Graham decided it was no longer unscriptural, but simply a local issue that had mischievously popped up where it did not belong. Not long afterward, he covered this fast-rising waffle with still another topping. In a letter to one of the leaders of a crusade planned for Detroit, he included a copy of the news story about his bold statements, but not the story of his clarification, with a comment, "I am certain this will be of interest to our colored brethren. I cannot be hypocritical on this matter. I do not preach one thing in the North and change my message in the South. This is a moral issue, and we take our stand. To take one stand in Mississippi is not too popular, but we had very little repercussions from this statement. Our Negro friends have attended in large numbers." Graham's behavior had not quite matched his alleged boldness, but the statement expressed truth as he wanted it to be, and that ideal pulled him along toward consistency. In March 1953, more than a year before the Supreme Court in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, ruled that segregated schools were unconstitutional, and more than a decade before the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Graham told the sponsoring committee of his Chattanooga crusade that he could not countenance the usual practice of segregated seating. When the committee balked, he went to the crusade tabernacle and personally removed the ropes marking the section reserved for blacks. In fact, few blacks dared to move into the white sections, and many people may not have realized what Graham had done. The incident passed without comment in the local papers, but he could not know what might happen, and the gesture was significant. In Dallas a few months later, he backslid a bit by accepting the sponsoring committee's designation of separate seating areas for blacks and whites. But ushers made no attempt to hinder the small number of blacks who chose to sit in areas reserved for whites. When a black Detroit newspaper reported the segregated arrangements in Dallas, the pastor of a Baptist church in that city informed Graham that his church would not participate in the upcoming crusade and blasted him for bowing to racist practices. Crusade director Willis Haymaker responded that Dallas law mandated segregated seating, and that however much they might dislike certain laws, they felt bound to obey them. Billy Graham, he asserted, was deeply committed to improving race relations, but he intended to do it by preaching the gospel, not by breaking the law. Some black churchmen in Detroit continued to doubt Graham's commitment, but others participated actively on various committees and were quite visible on the platform and in the choir and usher corps. Reassured and buoyed by the harmony of the meetings, Graham proclaimed that the church must practice the Christianity it professes. The state, the sports world, and even the business field are way ahead of the church in getting together racially, and church people should be the first to step forward and practice what Christ taught, that there is no difference in the sight of God. Racial discrimination, he warned, hurt American foreign policy and frustrated the work of Christian missionaries. Still, without explaining why secular institutions were moving more quickly toward racial harmony than was the church, or why the plight of blacks seemed particularly discouraging in that section of the country most heavily populated with born-again Christians, he reaffirmed his basic conviction that a great spiritual revival is needed to relieve the racial and political tensions of the day. The Christian Century, though skeptical of Graham's individualistic approach to social issues, commended him for his statements in Detroit and acknowledged his growing insistence on integrated crusades. While in Detroit, Graham explicitly rejected as unbiblical the racist contention that dark skin and the inferior social position of blacks derived from a curse Noah placed on Canaan, the son of Ham, Genesis chapter 9, verses 22 through 27, and were therefore part of a divinely sanctioned and unchangeable order. A few weeks later, in his syndicated column, he addressed the same issue from both a biblical and an anthropological perspective. To the question, does the Bible teach the superiority of any one race? He replied, definitely not. The Bible teaches that God hath made of one blood all the nations of the world. Anthropologists have come to two very important biological observations. First, there are no pure races. Second, there are no superior or inferior races. We know from history that all people upon contact have crossed their genetically based physical traits. We know from human anatomy that in fundamental structure, all people are identical. As far as biological man is concerned, what he is related to his cultural environment, rather than to any inherited ability or aptitude. Then, in oblique but unmistakable fashion, he lumped racists with Nazis. There is no German race, he observed, only a German nationality. There is no Aryan race, only an Aryan language. There is no master race, only a political bombast. In peace with God, he again indicted the church for allowing secular institutions to outshine its commitment to racial justice. The church should have been the pace setter, he lamented. The church should voluntarily be doing what the federal courts are doing by pressure and compulsion. And they should be doing it because the Holy Spirit had transformed their hearts and their perceptions. When true Christians look at other people, they see no color, nor class, nor condition, but simply human beings with the same longings, needs, and aspirations as our own. Billy Graham was now fully on the record against segregation and for racial equality. After the Supreme Court decision on May 17, 1954, he no longer permitted any form of enforced segregation in his meetings, even in the Deep South. Though he sometimes seemed less concerned with the intrinsic injustice of racial discrimination than with the effect on his ministry's image. Before his Nashville crusade in the fall of 1954, for example, he wrote to the crusade chairman, urging him to keep in mind that my ministry is now worldwide, and I have to be extremely careful in everything I do. Therefore, I would suggest that Negroes be allowed to sit anywhere they like in the open-air stadium, and that nothing be said one way or the other about it. It might be well if once a week you had a Negro pastor lead in prayer. There will likely be only a small group of Negroes come anyway. But if they were roped off or segregated into the back, it might cause trouble. Graham obviously felt no strong need to incorporate blacks into the crusade, as he had in Detroit. And they apparently got the message. Few attended the services, and those who did, though not required to, sat where black folk usually sat in that stadium. Consistent with his pacific and conciliatory nature, Billy would always prefer decorum to bold example, and he would never be comfortable with violent protest or even with nonviolent socially disruptive measures aimed at changing the standing order. Neither, however, would he ever retreat from the higher ground he had seized. Chapter 11. Harangay. None of Graham's predecessors was able to maintain peak levels of performance and response for more than a decade. In contrast, he would hold large and successful meetings for more than 40 years. Still, no crusade looms larger in the collective memory and mythos of the Graham organization than a 12-week effort at London's Harangay Arena in 1954. This campaign so defied expectations, so triumphed over skepticism and opposition, and so captured the attention and imagination of the English-speaking world, particularly the British Empire, that participants found it easy to believe they were living in the days foreseen in the rousing revival standard, from victory unto victory. His armies shall he lead, till every foe is vanquished, and Christ is Lord indeed. The impetus for the Billy Graham Greater London Crusade, as it was officially known, came from Britain's Evangelical Alliance, whose members came to know him during his Youth for Christ campaigns. Even within that body, the Salvation Army and Plymouth Brethren were more favorable toward him than were Baptists or Anglican evangelicals. The official invitation came in 1952, after Graham held a large rally at Royal Albert Hall and met with nearly 700 clergymen at Westminster to confront their fears and reservations about a full-scale crusade. Even so, the British Council of Churches, representing the great majority of British Christians, chose not to join in the invitation, and the Archbishop of Canterbury left no doubt about his reservations concerning such a campaign. Resistance took several forms. His theology, one liberal critic wrote, is 50 years behind contemporary scholarship. He gives no sign of having read any of it from the last 3 decades. He is completely out of step with a majority of ministers and pastors. Strict Calvinists objected to his use of the invitation, contending that salvation is by God, not something humans can simply choose to accept or reject. And a hardline fundamentalist, Graham's willingness to associate with those considered theologically unsound, which in their minds included not only most Anglicans, but many members of the Evangelical Alliance, marked him as one to be shunned rather than encouraged. Also at work, of course, was a lingering streak of anti-Americanism and resistance to what many perceived as hot gospel, high-pressure salesmanship. This lack of broad-based support gave Graham pause, but he hoped the extensive network of friendships formed during his YFC tours would rally the support he needed. He did not expect to change the life of Britain, he admitted, but he did hope to start a spark that may someday ignite something. Determined not to let the crusade fail for lack of preparation, Graham ordered full-scale deployment of the 2 weapons he trusted most, prayer and publicity. Well before the crusade started, more than 18,000 people in Great Britain were praying for its success, as were thousands of Americans, including Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, who led a contingent of high government officials at a Washington send-off prayer rally for Graham. Though Billy regarded prayer as the key instrument of assault on the spiritual vacuum he professed to find in England, he provided impressive backup support from a Bevan-engineered promotional campaign so dazzling that both the Publicity Club and the Advertising Club of London named it the top advertising effort of the year. The first time an American had won either award, and the first time a single campaign had won both awards. The Blitz, whose £50,000 price tag astonished the Crusade Committee, included nearly 10,000 press announcements, almost 30,000 posters bearing the evangelist picture, and the simple directive, "Hear Billy Graham," and hundreds of thousands of handbills. In addition, Graham discussed the campaign thoroughly with President Eisenhower and informed Crusade Director Willis Haymaker that the President not only heartily endorses it and would be praying for its success, but is using his great influence behind the scenes to help. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, who agreed that Britain must have a spiritual renaissance to survive, would also be using his considerable prestige to help by writing letters to all of his friends and contacts in England. Perhaps at Dulles' recommendation, American Ambassador to Great Britain Winthrop Aldrich promised his assistance as well. With prayer, publicity, and political patronage lined up in support, Graham set sail for London in February 1954. 3 days before the United States reached Southampton, he learned that a crucial 4th ingredient, the press, had waded in against the tide to urge that he turn back from England's shores. Early press response to the pre-Crusade publicity barrage had been largely negative, filled with derisive barbs aimed at Graham's style and substance. In a typical story, the London Evening News called him an American hot gospel specialist, who served as actor-manager of the show, and declared that, like a biblical Baedeker, he takes his listeners strolling down pavements of gold, introduces them to rippling, muscled Christ, who resembles Charles Atlas with a halo, then drops them abruptly into the lake of fire for a sample scalding. Such appraisal stung, but they were hardly unique and not nearly so problematic as the newest charge being leveled. Now the press claimed, Billy Graham not only had the gall to decide that England's religious life needed reviving, but had attacked a major aspect of its political life as well. The new charge stemmed from an organizational snafu. Because of the difficulty and expense of arranging for large auditoriums for long campaigns, and particularly because London lacked what Graham considered a satisfactory arena, he had accepted R.G. Letourneau's proposal to design and build an immense portable aluminum tabernacle, 300 feet in diameter, with a seating capacity of 12,000 to 14,000. Constructed of a series of concentric rings that could be hoisted, rather like an inverted collapsible camper's cup, to form an all-weather dome. The initial cost would be high, but it would ultimately be a great money saver, and the publicity value of such a futuristic structure, plopped, for example, along the banks of the Thames like a gleaming spaceship, would be enormous. To raise money for the venture, Jerry Bevan designed an expensive oversized brochure to be sent to a small number of wealthy American backers. In describing the tabernacle's proposed use in the London Crusade, he described England as a nation that lost its historic faith during and immediately following World War II, until the churches still standing were gradually emptied. The text left no doubt where to place the blame. And when the war ended, a sense of frustration and disillusionment gripped England, and what Hitler's bombs could not do, socialism, with its accompanying evils, shortly accomplished. When Bevan showed proofs of the brochure to a member of Parliament with ties to the Conservative Party in June 1953, the MP found misspellings of several British names and a misquotation of Shakespeare. He also noted that the reference to socialism, particularly if written with a capital S, would offend members and supporters of the Labour Party, which had played a key role in rebuilding Britain after the war and regarded socialism as an honorable term. As it happened, the brochure was never distributed. Buckminster Fuller's new invention, the geodesic dome, might well have served Graham's needs. R.G. Letourneau's concentric rings turned out to be less than an architectural breakthrough. During the summer of 1953, Hugh Gough, Anglican Bishop of Barking and chair of the Greater London Crusade, flew to Texas to allay his doubts about the fantastic structure. As he stood in the broiling sun at Letourneau's Longview plant, sweat drenching his dust-stained purple dickey, while he watched workmen struggle to attach the third ring to the two already in place, the entire contraption collapsed in a groaning, clanging heap. The bishop dryly observed, "I say, I don't think it is going to work." He was right, and when he returned to London, the Crusade Committee made arrangements to hire Haringey Arena, a drab barn-like structure used mostly for boxing matches and located next door to a dog track in a run-down and unattractive section of North London. They feared Christian people might resist coming to the arena because of its association with gambling. But they had no better option. With the tabernacle project aborted, Bevan scrapped the brochure and gave it no more thought. Back in Minneapolis, however, George Wilson saw an uncorrected copy and used some of its text, including the reference to socialism, in a 1954 calendar sent to BGEA supporters to keep them aware of the year's major activities. As soon as someone aware of the brochure's history saw the first copies off the press, the offending word was changed to secularism. But at least one of the uncorrected versions found its way to England. The MP's apprehensions had been correct. In a stinging attack in the London Daily Herald, columnist Hannon Swaffer quoted the calendar and asked just which evils Graham was laying at the feet of socialism. The abolition of the poor law? The National Health Service? Town planning? Family allowances? Improved educational facilities? Charging that the calendar's assertion was a foul lie, he demanded that Graham apologize or stay away. Labour MP Geoffrey de Freitas sounded the same note and announced plans to challenge Graham's admission to England on the ground that he was interfering in British politics under the guise of religion. The Central Council of the Socialist Christian League also characterized the statements as an attack on the British Labour government, which was in power from 1945 to 1951. When the United States docked briefly at Le Havre, France, a crew of reporters came on board to question him about his alleged attitude toward socialism. Off Southampton, a tug pulled alongside the liner and several dozen reporters and photographers boarded to launch another assault. Graham's response was immediate and abject. First by cablegram and then by telephone, he assured the editor of the Daily Herald that it had all been a horrible mistake, that the calendar had been prepared by a New York advertising firm, and that the keyword should have read secularism instead of socialism. Further, he insisted that he had never attacked socialism, that he wished to apologize to all who may have been offended, and that his visit had no political implications whatever. Back in Minneapolis, George Wilson took full blame for not having caught the mistake, but none was more willing to fall on his pen than Jerry Bevin, who insisted that Graham had neither written nor approved the calendar's text. He further observed that even the original use of the word socialism contained no veiled reference to the Labour Party, because when spelled with a lowercase s, the word means in America theater-going, social life, materialism, and so on. Such explanations, dismissed by a Labour MP as fatuous and acknowledged by some of Graham's staunchest supporters to be less than fully convincing, were at best disingenuous. Just 3 months earlier, Graham had described Karl Marx as a subtle, clever, degenerate materialist, who, having filled his intellectual crawl with all the filth of Europe's gutters and garbling perverted German philosophies and half-truths, had spewed this filthy, corrupt, ungodly, unholy doctrine of world socialism over the gullible people of degenerate Europe. On various occasions, the evangelist had called for a revolt against the tranquil attitude toward communism, socialism, and dictatorship, predicted that England would turn to Marxist socialism within 5 years, indicated he might go there to help halt this trend, and described socialist leader and Iron Bevin, the major architect of the highly regarded National Health Service, as a dangerous man involved in communist advance. Even more pointedly, he had observed in 1949 that the present government, Labour, is killing all initiative and free enterprise. The system has not solved one of Britain's economic ills. Instead, it has created 1,000 economic problems. These views, neither uncommon nor unpopular in Eisenhower-era America, were sufficiently well reported to have gained the attention and approval of Kenneth de Courcy, the outspoken editor of London's extremely conservative Intelligence Digest, which hailed Graham as the most important single figure in the religious world today, described him as without doubt not very partial to socialism, and predicted that a major evangelical awakening would detach hundreds of thousands, if not millions, from the socialist concept. As a further show of his support, de Courcy arranged to reprint some of Graham's sermons and inaugurated a new paper, the London Free Press, which was advertised as possessing a strong editorial slant, fully supporting the Billy Graham message. In light of such evidence, Graham's insistence that he bore no animus toward socialism seemed quite unconvincing. And yet he not only weathered the storm, but soon turned most of his attackers into docile admirers. Within a few days, he visited the House of Commons as the guest of several Labour MPs, including Geoffrey de Freitas, who declared he had accepted Graham's apology for the offensive calendar and was impressed by his sincere Christianity. Ironically, the calendar flap made Billy and his crusade front page news. When he arrived at Waterloo Station, he was met by a crowd judged to be the largest together for any celebrity since Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks visited London in 1924. An eyewitness reported that women screamed and fainted. Babies and children were passed over the heads of the crowd, newspaper stands were overturned, and burly railway policemen were swept aside. And a harassed station official complained, "If these are Christians, it's time we let out the lions." None of this calmed Graham's deep-seated fear that he was facing certain and humiliating failure. On the evening of the opening service, March 1, as he and Ruth prepared to leave their modest quarters over a shoe shop near Oxford Circus. He received word that Senators Stuart Symington and Stiles Bridges, who had promised to say a few words at the service, had backed out, ostensibly because of a conflicting dinner engagement. Ambassador Aldrich had already distanced himself from Graham as a result of the calendar flap, and Billy wondered if Symington and Bridges had been persuaded to abandon him as well. To make matters worse, a steady mixture of sleet and freezing rain might well discourage people from leaving home. When Jerry Bevan called to report on the status of last-minute preparations, he noted that several hundred journalists were present, but the crowd was still quite small. Given his state of mind, Graham found it easy to envision newspapers and television screens filled with pictures of an empty arena. Ruth, who was writing in her diary when the call came, penned the following observation. "Jerry just called. Some of the team are getting discouraged. Bill looked sort of stunned when he told me, and I thought I heard him praying in the other room just now." In fact, Bevan had not been concerned, but a team member who took his call had misunderstood his message, and Billy characteristically feared the worst. As he and Ruth rode to the arena in a chauffeured car furnished by the Ford Motor Company of England, they held hands, and Billy stared into the drizzly darkness, mute with dread of humiliating failure. When they arrived at the warehouse-like arena, he saw no one outside, and steeled himself to face what he imagined would be a gang of mocking reporters, ready to slice him apart as he tried to communicate with scattered clumps of wet, dispirited fundamentalists. Then he saw Willis Haymaker rushing toward them, obviously filled with excitement. "The building is packed," he exclaimed, "and thousands are on the other side trying to get in. They've come in the last 20 minutes from everywhere. Listen to them sing." Tears filled Billy's eyes as he thanked God he had not been forsaken. When he entered the room that would serve as his office, he found Senators Symington and Bridges standing there smiling. They had broken loose from a cocktail party and would arrive late at their appointment, dinner with Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden. When at last it was time to mount the platform, Billy saw the jammed auditorium for himself. Filled with exhilaration, he could hardly wait to preach. He spoke too fast, and his voice was too loud, but the invitation reaped a harvest of 178 souls, a standard proportion, 1.5% for Graham Crusades, but eye-popping to the reticent British. And the most remarkable religious revival in modern British history was underway. On the second evening, snow and rain kept the crowd a bit below capacity, but on no more than 2 or 3 nights of the remaining 12 weeks did a single spot in the 12,000-seat arena go unfilled. On weekends, extra services were scheduled to accommodate overflow crowds. Each night, coachloads of pilgrims traveled hundreds of miles to attend the services, and entire tube trains rang with a chorus that would become a standard in Graham Crusades. "To God be the glory, great things he hath done." Haringey marked the introduction of a new technique that would become a vital and standard part of subsequent crusades. Stephen Olford, who led Billy into a deeper walk with the Holy Spirit during those memorable sessions at Pontypridd, had left itinerant evangelism to become pastor of London's Duke Street Baptist Church. From his own experience, he knew that most people who attended evangelistic services were already affiliated with a church, and he puzzled over ways to increase the proportion of the unchurched at such meetings and to make sure they did not simply drift back into the night after the services. His solution was biblical, elegantly simple, and remarkably effective. The Duke Street Church would furnish free transportation and arrange for reserved seating for any member who wished to attend the crusade. Bus and crusade tickets were free, but they came in batches of no less than 2, and all church members who received a ticket for themselves were obliged to bring at least one unconverted person with them, preferably a friend, relative, or associate. "It was," Olford recalled with considerable satisfaction, "entirely my vision, entirely my procedure." He called it Operation Andrew, after the apostle whose primary recorded contribution to Jesus' ministry was inviting his brother Peter to meet the Messiah, John chapter 1, verses 40 through 42. The scheme, Olford recalled, proved to be a smashing success. We drove multitudes of people to Haringey, multitudes, and we trebled our membership at Duke Street, actually trebled. I knew what it took, and we proved it could work. Veteran team members dispute Olford's claim to sole credit for Operation Andrew, but freely acknowledge it was a British invention, and quickly made it a regular part of Crusade operations. As the Crusade gathered momentum, the problem was not how to fill Haringey, but how to reach other multitudes for whom regular attendance was simply not feasible. At the suggestion of an ABC engineer who came along to help with Hour of Decision broadcast, and in keeping with evangelical openness toward any innovation that promised to lengthen the reach or enhance the effectiveness of efforts to fulfill the Great Commission, to preach the gospel to all nations, the team experimented with landline relays that transmitted the service over telephone lines to loudspeakers set up in churches or rented halls. After a single installation at the Trossett Cinema in South London showed the technique would work, other lines were hired, and by May, the Crusade was going out to 430 churches and rented halls in 175 different cities and towns in England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. In these services, team members or local church leaders led the singing and prayers and took an offering to pay the cost of the relay and hall rental. Then when the time for the sermon came, the landline transmission began. In Liverpool, the congregation looked at a 6-foot-high portrait of Graham while they listened to his voice over the loudspeaker. In most locations, they simply sat and listened. In virtually all cases, the clarity of the transmission, often noticeably better than the sound in Haringey, made it easy to concentrate on the sermon. And observers noticed that the level of attention and response at the invitation was at least as good and often better than at the live services. At the same time, because those who conducted the services were usually local churchmen, and attendance seldom exceeded a few hundred, critics could hardly claim that response to the invitation was a product of an emotionally charged mass meeting manipulated by charismatic professionals. Popular acclaim helped Graham gain entry to more elite circles as well. Near the end of the Crusade, he addressed almost 200 British political and social elites who gathered at the posh Claridge's Hotel for a white-tie dinner, ostensibly hosted by Lord Luke of Pavenham, a dedicated evangelical Anglican, but actually paid for by Sid Richardson. At Cambridge and Oxford, he drew capacity crowds, and then he addressed large gatherings at the University of London, Imperial College in Kensington, and at the London School of Economics, LSE. Graham approached the LSE appearance with trepidation. Though invited by the school's Christian Union, he was well aware of its openly secular orientation and an outspoken leftist element. A few moments after he was introduced by a professor who noted he was the first minister ever to speak from that platform, a student crashed through an upper window and stood scratching himself like an ape, an obvious jibe at fundamentalism's rejection of evolution. Graham instantly made the connection, and when he finished laughing, quipped, "He reminds me of my ancestors." The students roared appreciatively, and then he added, "Of course all my ancestors came from Britain." This brought the house down, and from then on he had them. Whether or not any of them changed their mind about his message, they listened in complete silence to his brief gospel presentation. Similar triumphs attended the rest of the Crusade. Nearly every day, Graham addressed a new group or met with religious or political leaders. The pace exhausted him. He lost weight, and the circles around his eyes darkened even more. But the thrill and satisfaction of doing some great thing for God kept him moving from glory to glory. An open-air service in Trafalgar Square drew an estimated 12,000 people, the largest crowd to gather there since VE Day. More than 40,000 children assembled one Saturday morning at the dog track, next to Haringey, to hear Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, and Trigger, the gospel horse, entertain and give their testimony. A Good Friday rally in Hyde Park, attracted another 40,000, and two services on the closing day, one at White City Stadium and the other at Mammoth Wembley Stadium, drew, despite driving rain, overflow audiences totaling at least 185,000. The largest crowds ever assembled for a religious event in British history, and larger than any crowd at the 1948 Summer Olympics at Wembley. The Lord Mayor of London attended the Wembley service in official capacity,